Morning, Oregon. I'm Finn J.D. John, FJ at offbeatoregon.com, and this is the daily Offbeat Oregon History Podcast. Happy Friday! And to help you celebrate, today I have a brand new show for you, which has just come out from under the 60-day embargo period during which our participating newspapers have exclusive rights. So thanks for joining me, and I hope you enjoy the show. This story was first published on April 13th of 2025 under the headline, Wife Acquitted of Murder After Shooting Husband. Here we go. Dawn was only a couple hours away when 33-year-old lumber mill owner Gene Harrington got home from a really long night. He pulled into the driveway around 5:45 a.m. and immediately proceeded to wake up his pretty young wife, Virginia, along with their two babies, ages 1 and 2. It's not clear why he woke up the kids, but Virginia tucked the two back into bed. And after that, an argument ensued. Virginia later said that it was a bad one. At one point, Gene threatened to kick her out of the house, and at another point, he threatened to push her down the basement stairs. Finally, she said, around 7:45 a.m., he got undressed for bed. But then he got back up again and got into the closet and got out his .38 special.
"I'm getting this so you won't," he said.
Then he put it down on the floor beside the bed. The couple continued their argument. Virginia wanted Gene to stop drinking. Gene wanted Virginia to get off his back and maybe have a drink or two herself. She was a teetotaler. And he, as you will have gathered, was not. She probably accused him of having an affair. After all, he had been out all night. Then something happened. Precisely what, only Virginia really knew afterward, but after it was over, Gene Harrington was dead, a pair of .38 caliber bullets buried deep in his brain. Virginia told police he threatened to shoot her with the .38 and grabbed her left arm. Instead of trying to pull away, she had stepped across, snatched the gun away from him, and fired it at him twice. She said she did not at first realize he was dead and called a friend to ask what she should do. The friend told her to get an ambulance on the way quick and also call the police. She did, and when they arrived, they found Gene Harrington quite dead. But they thought Virginia's story was a little fishy. After all, what 23-year-old 1940s housewife is good enough with a pistol to do what she said she had done? Snatch a strange gun out of a man's hand, get a grip on it, find the trigger, and put two rounds into his eye, all the while he clutches and presumably pulls on her arm? Gene Harrington had not always been a mill-owning big shot. He'd started out as a log truck driver. Just before the Second World War, he'd bought a small sawmill, which he ran on a shoestring, but then, when the war broke out, the booming market for lumber made it possible for him to expand the operation into two mills, both of them in Eugene. In 1944, he married Virginia and settled down to start a family with her. After the war, the Harringtons bought a home in Eugene's fancy College Hill neighborhood and a brand new Packard luxury car for Gene to drive to work in. It was quite an upgrade from the old log truck, and he looked from the outside like he'd really made it. But apparently those appearances were deceiving. On the fatal night, according to witnesses, Harrington had gone out for dinner and drinks to a cafe on the outskirts of Eugene. In the party with him were his secretary from the office, a real estate agent named Eugene Florence, Florence's wife, and a third woman who isn't named. After midnight, the ladies all returned home, and Harrington and Florence went to another all-night cafe to have a few more pops and talk about Harrington's plan to sell his lumber mills. Around 2:30 or 3, the two men went together to inspect the mills. This seems like a very strange thing to do at 3 o'clock in the morning, but perhaps Harrington didn't want his employees to know he was thinking about selling. While touring one of the mills, Florence testified that Harrington actually telephoned his wife. This would have been around 4 a.m. The conversation apparently didn't go very well, and Harrington asked the mill's night watchman to speak to her.
"She thinks I'm with a woman," he said.
Florence testified that Harrington had had several drinks throughout the evening and into the morning, but he was not visibly drunk at all. Virginia, who actually testified in her own defense, said that was not the case, and that Harrington had been quite drunk when he came home. He was, she said, a different man when drunk, and often became abusive after drinking heavily. Harrington's blood was tested at the morgue after his death, but the result is listed in the paper as 0.017%. If that's correct, it's less than the effect of one glass of beer, but I suspect it's a misprint because such a finding would have utterly destroyed Virginia's case. If instead the paper meant to print 0.17%, well, that's a significant level of intoxication. Most people lose consciousness and pass out at 0.20%, but experienced heavy drinkers can function fairly normally at such levels. Was Harrington such a drinker, as his wife testified he was? That most likely was the primary thing on the jury's minds as they filed out of the courtroom to deliberate. But the prosecution really didn't have a lot to work with. Their case rested mostly on the oddness of some of the details, like the ninja-class trick shooting Virginia said she'd done, and the fact that the bed on which Harrington's body lay did not appear to be messed up as by a struggle. Their allegation was that she had simply waited for him to fall asleep, then stepped up beside the bed, squared off, took careful aim, and shot him twice in the head as he lay there. In the end, the evidence to support that theory must have been pretty thin because the jury took less than 2 hours deliberating before they brought in a verdict of not guilty. So, what really happened? Only one person knew, and therein lay the problem. It's hard to get beyond all reasonable doubt without some kind of solid evidence, and in this case it was mostly a case of he said, she said, with the he said part lopped off. It no doubt helped a good deal that in court, Virginia did not at all behave like a murderess is assumed to act. She was very worried about the two babies while they were in state custody waiting for their grandmother to arrive from San Jose. She was quite emotional in all the right ways during her testimony. Of course, some murderers are very good at that kind of acting, but it seems unlikely a 23-year-old would have acquired such skills. And yet her account of how the shooting happened rings very false. To snatch a gun from the hand of a much stronger person, shift one's grip on the gun without using the other hand, because remember, she said he was holding her arm, and firing unaimed in double-action mode with her wrist bent, punching 2 rounds dead center through the bullseye. As anyone who's fired a double-action revolver will appreciate, it takes a good deal of training to be able to accurately shoot one in double-action mode. The long, heavy pull on the trigger that is required to rotate the cylinder and raise the hammer, and the way the trigger breaks free suddenly when the hammer is released, tends to cause the muzzle to wander around. Yet this pretty young mom, the jury members were told, had held the muzzle right on target for 2 unaimed shots, holding the gun sideways across her body? Even from 2 feet away, that's truly Annie Oakley-class trick shooting. One lucky hit would be plausible, but the chance of the second shot also being a near-perfect hit would have been vanishingly slight. The story can basically be dismissed out of hand, and it probably was. So the jury must have decided that Harrington had had it coming. Or maybe they just didn't want to finish the job of making orphans of their 2 kids. Either way, they came to their verdict very quickly and decisively. As a side note, the newspaper coverage of the Harrington case was fairly subdued, probably because it was overshadowed by the far more salacious case of Gladys Ralphs Broadhurst, the bigamous film noir murderess from Harney County, which took place at roughly the same time. Newspaper stories about the two murders appeared next to each other several times during the trial. If you're not familiar with the Gladys Ralphs Broadhurst story, it's a doozy, and you should definitely look it up on the Offbeat Oregon History website. It was published in March of 2025. Key sources in this story included works by Douglas Perry and the Portland Morning Oregonian Archives from January to March of 1947. Well, that's our show for today. Thanks again for listening, and I do hope you enjoyed it. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. Check out our hub page at offbeatoregon.com to explore all the other things we do or to find the full citations and visuals that go with today's show. If you haven't already, check out our Offbeat Oregon books. They're basically revised, updated, and re-researched collections of these columns and podcasts, arranged by topic. So far, we've done Heroes and Rascals of Old Oregon, Love, Sex, and Murder in Old Oregon, and Bad Ideas and Horrible People of Old Oregon. You can find them in the hardcover, softcover, ebook, and audiobook, wherever you get your reading materials or, you know, on Amazon or whatever. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band and was written by Carmen Ficarra. Listen and download more at atlasstringband.com. Offbeat Oregon History episodes come out once per weekday, usually around 6 a.m. So it won't be long before the next episode is on your device and ready for you to queue up and enjoy. And until then, go out and fill up the rest of the day and the weekend with good stuff. Bye now.